Does it ever feel like you're a marketing professional just
speaking into the void?
Well, with LinkedIn ads, you can know you're reaching the right decision makers. You can even target buyers by job title, industry, company, seniority, skills. Wait, did I say job title yet? Get started today and see how you can avoid the void and reach the right buyers with LinkedIn ads. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next campaign. Get started at linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply.
This is the way it feels to move through summer in Lululemon. Iconic align softness without the front seam. For our smoothest look and feel ever, summer won't know what hit it. Stretch your limits in the non-stop flexibility of the new Lululemon Align No Line Pant in select stores and at lululemon.com.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Tech Entrepreneur on a Mission podcast. My name is Ton Dobbe and I'm the founder of Value Inspiration and the author of The Remarkable Effect. I envision a world where every B2B SaaS startup succeeds because they're creating software that customers would miss if they were gone. And here's why. Research consistently shows that 90% of all startups fail, and that's bad. What's worse, however, is that 75% of SaaS scale-ups fail, companies that are supposed to have product market fit. Far too few scale-ups create the traction they aspire for and fail for the wrong reasons. And I believe this should stop. And hence I created my business. And the goal that I have with this podcast is twofold. First, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential that we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. Secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what it requires to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. The guest on my podcast this week is Dan Oemora, CEO of Pushpress.
Money is an output. It's the result of energy spent somewhere else. So the problem is a lot of people build their business around money. How do I make more money? How do I generate more money? How do I increase my top line, bottom line? The reality is like that's an output and you can never affect an output. You can only affect the input. And the input is the order of magnitude and sheer volume of value you provide to customers. That's what you got to focus on.
This is Dan. He had an entrepreneurial spirit from a young age. He was a dot-com era pioneer. During college, he founded Mixture.com, a platform that was ahead of its time and preceded social media giants like MySpace. After working in tech, including his stint at MySpace, he made a dramatic career pivot by opening his own CrossFit gym. But he quickly got frustrated with the poor software options available for gym management. So in January 2012, he leveraged his tech background to create Pushpress and rebel against manual paperwork and complicated, overpriced software. Their mission? To make gym management the easiest part of starting a fitness business. And that inspired me, and hence I invited Dan to my podcast. We explore his journey from being a MySpace coder to gym owner to software entrepreneur. Dan shares his insights on what it takes to create competitive advantage that's hard to beat. He elaborates on empathy-driven support, value-based pricing, and the layer cake approach that makes his SaaS products invaluable. He emphasizes the importance of focusing on customer value over traditional SaaS metrics and shares innovative strategies to outmaneuver competitors. Last but not least, he shares his data-driven decision-making framework and lessons on team building. By listening to this podcast, you will learn four things. Firstly, how he's tuning his product strategy to grow a highly defensible position against competitors. Secondly, his framework for building conviction and speeding up decision-making in feature development. Thirdly, how he overcame the balancing act of horizontal feature breadth with vertical depth improvement. And lastly, his approach to innovative pricing models to outmaneuver competitors and accelerate growth. Well, hi, Dan. Thank you for making the time available today and being the guest on the podcast.
Absolutely. Happy to be here and excited to have a chat with you about starting a business.
Yeah. Well, starting a business, you started your business already 12 years ago. So it's I'm really eager to understand the whole journey to where you are right now. And it's actually a topic dear to my heart. I've been exercising all my life, been in so many gyms and indeed had to deal with all kind of manual stuff of kind of organizing how I had to pay and so on. So out of the 340 interviews that I've done so far, you're the first one that actually has created a platform for gym owners. So that's unique in itself, or remarkable in itself.
That's interesting, because I feel like I have 340 competitors out there. So,
which shows me again that there's plenty of room to do another 3,000 podcasts. But yeah. Okay, before you start talking about your company, Push Press, love the name. A little bit about you. What drives you? What gives you energy as an entrepreneur?
I think I've always identified as someone who likes to help people. And I guess it's always been married by the fact that I've been driven to, I guess, make my own way in life. I don't know where that came from. I don't know if it was born in me or some nurture versus nature. But I've always inherently been pretty empathetic and wanted to help people. And I've always, as far back as I can remember, wanted to earn money. I had paper routes. I set up brownie stands, lemonade stands. Like, as a kid, used to go and sell things at school that I bought. Like, I went to go to Chinatown, buy a bunch of like switchblade combs, bring them back to junior high and sell them for a profit. Like, I was always this way, wired this way. So I got pulled. I didn't force my way into this. It just was a pull. Yeah.
Yeah. I saw that when I was doing a little bit of research around you, the lemonade stands. Yeah. Fascinating. Love to see you some pictures from that time. But okay. 2012. I mean, my research also said that you've been a gym owner. I'm not sure in what time period that was, but in 2012, you decided to start your company, Push Press. What was the problem that you saw back then that was screaming for a solution that you are creating right now?
Yeah. So before I opened a gym, I was an internet developer, web developer. I guess you call him just an engineer in today's speak, but I was an engineer. Yeah. I was actually working at MySpace at the time. And I kind of got tired writing code for things that I didn't necessarily believe in. Like, I was just, as an entrepreneur, you want to do things that are contributing to society. And I felt like I was just taking jobs to earn money to pay off my mortgage, you know, like, and it was making me feel pretty bleak inside. So I actually got laid off from MySpace when they were going through a reorg. And I just took my severance and decided to open a gym, because I had always been connected with gyms. I love the communities that happen inside small gyms. Like, it actually like kind of fulfilled my inner needs more so than my financial needs. So I was like, let's go complete 180 and open a gym. And when I did that as a software person, I immediately looked for software to run my gym. And I quickly found that from what I knew could be built, because I was building modern, you know, this is 2010 and modern stuff at that time, the software was not what I would expect it to be. So I just decided to roll my own at that point in time.
Yeah, see how this drive for entrepreneurship just creeps everywhere. And when you see a problem and it's not solved, then you solve it yourself.
It could be a blessing and a curse. I'll tell you how many, I've probably failed 100 companies or 100 ideas before. And then when you actually go all in on one and you decide one's the one, because I was doing everything all, you know, everywhere, probably like a lot of entrepreneurs out there, like, you never really get conviction in one thing. So you're building four things at once, just doesn't work. So,
okay. So what was the moment where you decided, okay, now I'm going to double down on this?
We just realized that this is like when boutique gyms were starting to pick up. Like, yoga had already had some traction, the CrossFit and the boutique like strength conditioning space was starting to pick up. And I realized, like, I was actually old enough. So I was like 34, 35 at the time, mature enough to see things that I couldn't see before. The pattern recognition was there. And I was fully trying to get myself away from just taking jobs to earn money. Because the problem with being an engineer is you make a lot of money. So it's hard to turn away a good salary. So I was like, this is actually something I can work in an area that I love, that I believe in, and can end up paying me enough to actually sustain a lifestyle as well. So that's when I doubled down. We've kind of built a team around building the software. And then on top of that, because I was a gym owner who was in the tech space, I was working with a lot of gym owners to help them understand how to build websites, how you build funnels, how you build commerce on websites. This was new at the time. And I realized from the sheer amount of gym owners that needed help, that there was actually a huge demand and need for some guidance and some tech solutions in the space that weren't there previously. So kind of just wrap all that up together and just realize opportunities there. Let's go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Makes total sense. And you speak the language. That is a very important part as well. You know, you're one of them. That builds a lot of trust and also making the right bets in terms of what you're going to develop first. So that's my next question. What has been an early decision in back in 2012 or that stage that is still, that's actually defined your success today? Has there been one, maybe on the tech side or the go-to-market side?
Yeah, actually there is one. So, and I think this has been commonly understood now, but at the time in 2012, it wasn't. Back then, all of the software companies that were servicing our space, and I would wager across all verticals, across all of these niches, not fitness, but other like coffee shops and everything else that was going on, were owned by like payment companies or private equity owned companies who were so out of touch with what our consumers actually need, what we actually needed. So I think around 2012, when we happened to do this, it happened everywhere. So I bet you now, if you look across all of the industries, restaurant software, like Talk was built by the founder of Alina, the restaurant. You know, there's probably a coffee shop software that was built by a coffee shop guy. And you go, you know, a funeral home one that was built by a funeral home guy. And there was probably this mass movement at the time where there was a disconnect between what customers, like you said, how they speak, where they are, how they think, what they need, and what these private equity companies and these payments companies could understand that they needed to build for them. And so we doubled down on that. And I think to answer your question directly, here's one of the biggest decision points we made early. I remember being a software customer, and not just for the gym software, but also for like support software and all these other things. And this is when Intercom was starting to break out. And it was like, you ask the support chat for help. I would ask a question. And as a small business owner, as a gym owner, I needed help right there because I had 100 other problems stacking up, but I was working on this one right now. And I wouldn't get replied back to you for 2 or 3 days. And that not only would piss me off in the moment, because it's like, I've got to solve this right now and I need help. Nobody was there. But then when they finally got back to me 2 or 3 days later, they reminded me that they weren't there for me for 2 or 3 days. And that pissed me off again. Like they pissed me off twice for that, right? And it impacted my business. So when we launched Push Press, we decided in that moment that our goal was to answer every support question within 5 minutes. That was a standard we set. Nobody else did it. It actually like negatively affects your gross margin. It negatively affects a lot of like traditional SaaS metrics that people believe in and look at. And my opinion is, I don't care. Because if you like, we've actually turned customer support into a go-to-market motion, which is now I think it makes sense, but at the time was a bet that we made that I think paid off pretty well.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't make sense maybe from a like making money perspective.
Yeah.
Or how do you see? Yeah, it's looking at it from the internal perspective. But on the other hand, you know, happy customers buy more often, and bring their peers. So
exactly,
it will come back to you.
Yeah, and that's the problem in general I see with a lot of companies is you start answering to investors and you do the things the investors want, but what investors want and what your customers want don't always line up. And so my general theory in life is, and this is a Naval concept, is like money is the material form of value. You know, so you deliver value, you get money because money can be used to return the value at a future date, right? It's kind of like that's how money works. And unless you're focused on delivering value to your customers, you don't earn the right to make money. You might make money, but it's the longevity of it and the durability of it decreases the more you're only worried about making money. You have to always focus on your customer.
Well said.
Yeah.
I like the way you phrase it there. Money is the material representation of value. Exactly.
Yeah. So and to me, like I look at the entire business landscape as inputs and outputs. Money is an output. It's the result of energy spent somewhere else. So the problem is a lot of people build their business around money. How do I make more money? How do I generate more money? How do I increase my top line, bottom line? The reality is like, that's an output and you can never affect an output. You can only affect the input. And the input is the order of magnitude and sheer volume of value you provide to customers. That's what you got to focus on.
Well, it's the essence of my book, The Remarkable Effect, because it follows exactly that pattern. So we are aligned, very well aligned here.
But it's crazy. Yeah, because once we start thinking about business, we get sucked into the output. How do I make more money? How do I improve my NRR? How do I improve, you know, all of these other things? But really, it's like you got to focus on what's driving these things.
Exactly. Yeah. If you measure your success by the impact you help your customers create, value will come your way.
Yeah.
And likely in buckets you cannot even forecast for. But it requires a decision. So on that journey, you started building the software. You decided that you're going to differentiate through a combination of technology and how you actually treat your customers, how you support them to create that value. What has been the hardest nut to crack to get your flywheel going or your traction going?
Yeah, that's a really good question. To be honest, if I could go back a decade and talk to myself when I was starting it, I'd probably talk myself out of it now. But we are too far along to rethink this at this point. Not that I believe in sunk cost fallacies, but we've actually solved a lot of the hard problems. The reality is probably, at least in our space, in the gym space, but probably across every vertical SaaS, it's a much bigger problem to solve than you think. And we realized this pretty early on when we had to build landing pages as a feature, and our landing pages were being measured against ClickFunnels. And then we had to build wavering, because at gyms, you have to sign a waiver. So e-signatures and DocuSign-y stuff, and our e-signature feature was being measured against DocuSign. And then we had to build scheduling, which was being measured against Acuity and Calendly. And we realized real quick, like, we have to build billion-dollar features against $139 ARPU. Like, it doesn't, and we have to do this across the horizontal of everything we do. So the hardest nut to crack is that, like, how do you build a good enough feature set where you're competing against billion-dollar companies that focus on that, but make it work across the whole platform so that it's congruent and intuitive and easy enough for a small business owner who has no money for training, no time for training, no staff, to be able to consume it all and use it all. Very, very difficult nut to crack. I thought it would be 1,000 times easier than it was. But you know, thankfully we've done it.
So how do you then make decisions on make, buy, partner type of scenarios? Because I mean, could also say, okay, well, this is core business. This is how we create a differentiation for a certain number of those components. I'm going to reach out to kind of people where it's their core business.
Exactly. And that's a really hard decision point that we have to make. And so the framework we've kind of built is this core and unique to our experience, or the core things that happens to happen within a gym? And the answer for most of those questions allows us to dictate which way we're going to go with it. So some of the stuff we build, okay, so an example, like CRM system, which is like lead automation, lead nurturing, workflow automation, you know, that kind of stuff. We partner with a company called High Level. And that's because that product, again, they built a multi-billion dollar company focusing on accelerating the feature and value set of that product. However, the value that we bring that's unique isn't the automations and the workflows. It's connecting the specific gym member data with that to produce intelligent workflows that actually mimic the life cycle that a gym member needs, right? So Go High Level could never understand how to marry when a member joins, like when is the right time to ask for a referral and all of these types of things. They just built the platform. And so we decided we're going to spend all our time in the integration and the data transfer and the syncing and not in building the actual core architecture. With some of the other things. So again, the problem we have is gym owners don't want to spend $1,000 a month to build a full stack of software. So they're not going to pay DocuSign $60 a month and Calendly $60 a month. They want to pay $150 a month and have it all solved. So that dictates the fact that we have to build our own light version of documentation and light version of scheduling. But when it comes to the high level stuff, they will pay for lead automation and nurturing. So we partner out and pay for that.
Yeah, well said. I mean, I come from the ERP world. ERP is, of course, also like a stack of integrated features. And we were also competing against the best in breed.
Yeah.
It's a choice. You know, some customers will always go best of breed and others will just be happy with this mantra of all in one. Although I hate that name, but it's a choice, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like, what do you try to get out of it? So you already mentioned when I said there's been 340 or more interviews with SaaS founders on this podcast, that you had more than 300 competitors yourself. What have you done from the start to find differentiation that is actually defensible?
Oh, the defensible part's a good question. So let's start about differentiation first, because differentiation, I think in general, is difficult to defend in perfect markets. But when we started, it was mostly private equity backed companies that were in the market, or companies that were built around payment companies. And they were just trying to, you know, create more ways for payments to occur. At that point in time, the differentiation, I think, was pretty easy. It was the fact that we were built by gym owners. We were for gym owners. We understood the pain points. Like, we inherently understood everything they were going through, probably even before they understood it was coming, because I had only employed gym owners onto my team for the longest time. In fact, to this day, if you talk to somebody, if you're a customer of ours and you talk to us, they've owned a gym. So we pull, it's an interesting, it's a super interesting thing. I think fitness might be one of the only places you can do this, but I'm hiring like account executives away from Salesforce or whatever, who also own a gym on part-time, on the spare time, and identify as fitness people. So it's like I'm connecting people's passions with their livelihood and allowing them to do it in our company. And my thesis was I could do that for customer support and sales, easy. But what I'm finding now is like, we just hired a powerlifter engineer and a, you know, an SRE who is into trail running and like maintains a run club. So it's like, we're able to connect people's passion with their job function. Anyways, I've digressed right there. The wedge, early wedge was, we understood your business. We talked the talk, we walked the walk, we knew your pain points, and we could help you solve them before you even got to them. Mm-hmm. Which I think now that's becoming more table stakes for the new companies coming up. Yeah, the private equity companies still can't figure that out.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah. So how does that, I mean, like you say, if you look at it from my perspective right now, yeah, that's what you expect. You know, people, you buy something from a company that understands your business, particularly if it's, of course, if it's a vertical suite like you offering. So how do you maintain that differentiation today?
Yeah, so it's a good question. I'm actually writing a 2020 or like a future strategic doc right now as we speak, and actually touches on some things that I'm thinking about. What we did is in 2019, we actually launched a free version of PushPress. And we launched this free version because I knew, strategically speaking, the private equity competitors that we had would never want to lower their price down to free. Like, it's just something they couldn't do because their investment thesis would not allow them to do it. So when we launched that free version, we launched that with, it was free to use the software, but like 4% on the payment side. So we actually made like a percent extra on the payment side of things. And the framing of it was, hey, we'll grow with you. You pay as you grow. And once you get to a certain revenue level, you just pay for the pro product, because then we'll floor you down to our normal payments. And you're actually saving money by going to our paid product. My future goal, which I think is a little bit more defensible, is to try to come up with a product direction that is completely free to start with every single product we build. So not just our core product, but also our CRM product. Also, like, our branded app already has a free component of a member app. And then our train, which is kind of like workout tracking and member value surfacing. We want to build a free version of that. So to me, that's defensible because we have unit economics that I don't believe anyone new in the industry can get. So yeah. If they're going to compete with us on a free product, we'll win on the revenue side. But the PE companies can't outbuild us, won't build a better product than us because they don't like to invest in R&D, and they cannot go down to free because their investors are not going to let that happen. So I think we've actually created a perfect wedge that nobody will be able to compete with.
I love that, you know, and it's, I've had a couple of those stories so far. This is another good one again. It proves again how you can actually start to combine a very good product with a unbeatable business model, and yeah, how that's just keeps everybody out.
I've been thinking about this for years, and I think we're actually at the point where it can happen. So it's and on top of that, we have investors who believe in the mission that we're doing. This marries our mission with the actual direction of the company. Like, it's, the synergy of it is all perfect. Like, we're here to support gyms, and what better way than to give them an actually true free product to start their business with? So that's going to be, you know, the next few years of our evolution will be focused on that. Bring all products down to truly free, and see how our competitors react to that.
Interesting. Well, with respect. So what is, I mean, this section at the end is going to make people reflect and sit back and say, wait a minute, what's happening here? And what is required to actually, what needs to be true for, in order for you to do something like that? So what are you looking for to put something together like this? And what are the levers you're pulling here?
Okay, so I think it starts with distribution and trust, which we've established already. So you can't do any of this without distribution and trust, which is why new competitors won't be able to play this game, because they won't have trust or distribution yet. What trust and distribution allows is you to create additional products that are higher value than the free tier. So to me, the free tier has to solve all basic functions, all basic business needs, but it doesn't go above and beyond. So it doesn't let them excel, right? It doesn't let them truly grow, but it lets them start or maintain a business. The paid tiers become things that become accelerators to their business, right? So this would be wiring your entire system with intelligent AI functionality that allows them to buy back dozens of hours of a week of their time and let AI handle things, right? It would include advanced analytics. It would include advanced workflowing or advanced functionality. Once you've established the trust at the base level that you're able to sufficiently run their business, you earn the right to say, now we can take your business to the next level if you will invest $150, $200, $500 a month into these different products. It's commonly known in the vertical SaaS space that the layer cake is how you make significant money in vertical SaaS. I mean, my playbook for this is we just start the layer cake at zero and we provide so much value that you are opting into paying for all of the key stuff later on.
Yeah.
There's plenty of, like, again, think of value to money, right? I could provide a gym in the future, tens of thousands of dollars of value, which will translate into a thousand, like I think of a 10x ratio. If I provide you $10,000 worth of value, you should pay me $1,000 cash. So if I can find a way to, you know, systematize and prove that I'm providing $10,000 of value to a gym, they're willing to pay, they should be willing to spend $1,000 a month for the service. And honestly, that's 3 or 4x more than any gym spends for any software today. And I think we can do it. But we started free.
Yeah. Good that you say that, because I mean, so many software companies just make the mistake to say, okay, well, what is our pricing? Look at 5 competitors and just be a little bit more, a little bit cheaper.
Yeah.
And I really like what you're doing here. You say, okay, what is the value we're providing? And you pay 10% of that. And it's an easy explanation. And then people want to buy from you, you know, happily paying a premium.
And actually, I think it creates a flywheel in some sorts, because if they can see the success other gyms are having, and that is the proof is in the pudding. Like, we're not, again, value to money. We're not just trying to charge things to make money. But if we are truly providing value, the purchase becomes a no-brainer. And then we can create within our own systems, like the ability to see and or hear from other gym owners how much value they're getting from certain software or services. We actually consider ourselves as service as a software, not software as a service, but some of our services, the actual upgrade motion becomes clearer, easier, and more well-defined. So that's kind of like, and again, it all just starts with like seeing your whole business as value delivery. That's just kind of the key.
Yeah. So how do you go about it when it comes to deciding? You already made a point about what you, when you decide for buy, make, buy, build. But the thing that you build, have you got certain frameworks in place, or do you give your development team certain mantras to determine that every time you deliver something new, it has that multiplier effect?
Oh, good question. Yeah, so we like to think of things. So one thing we're trying to do is build a better muscle of delivering value quicker. I think a true differentiator and between the companies that thrive and the companies that die will be time to value delivery. It has to be accelerating over time.
Let me make a small interruption here. Dan just made a critical remark that makes his company unbeatable. The aim to deliver new value to customers faster. A lot of software companies take a minimum viable approach, but Pushpress takes a minimum remarkable approach and then pushes the bar from there based on customer feedback and meanwhile accelerating pace. That becomes a machine, where at some point it becomes impossible for competitors to enter the market. And that's a trait remarkable software companies master. They acknowledge that they cannot please everyone. They focus on the essence and then create something valuable and desirable from the start. That's noticed and talked about. And you can master these traits as well. And the first step? Simply read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy, and inspiration will spark within 10 minutes. Back to the interview.
And so in that lens, we think of things kind of in a good, better, best framework. And we are actually building our teams now. Because again, we had so much stuff to build horizontally, it was hard to focus on one thing and take it to best. So historically speaking, I feel like we built everything to good and just moved on to the next thing because we had a laundry list of 1,000 things to do. Now we're trying to approach it more like we're going to build vertical stacks of like developer squads who are focused in certain regions of the app. And you take everything to at least better, if not into best. And we get good out immediately and start listening to what customers think, figure out like from there, we might adjust. Good now looks like this because the customers are telling us something, and you keep iterating towards whatever best can be before you move on. And then even you've got to keep have like a KTLO, keep the lights on crew. That's always maintaining and making sure like the best that we thought that everyone wanted now needs to go a little bit to the left. So we'll make that adjustment. So again, it's a difficult, I believe vertical SaaS, yeah, like getting over the hump of getting these teams together and having the depth of talent is really challenging. But once you kind of get there, there's a big snowball that can happen and we're there now.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, I understand how difficult it is to build this, yeah, this broad horizontal product. And it's about making bets. And I mean, it goes back to the differentiation story. You don't have to be the best in everything. I mean, I'd like to think about it more as, okay, we're different here and that creates a different experience. And that these are the things you can start to build on. And it's, yeah, for the rest, you can be as good as all the others.
That's a really good point. You don't have to be best at everything. In fact, you don't even have to be better at everything. You have to be better at the right things and best at the key things. Yeah, yeah,
exactly. And that is becoming your differentiator then. And I mean, you've already talked about a couple of, adding on a number of other differentiators, like your services and your price points that are also, you know, relatively simple to develop because you don't have to develop them. It's a choice. Let me see, looking at the time as well. So, yeah, I mean, if you look 13 years back, what would be a thing that you'd do different next time? Because you already mentioned, if I look back right now, I wouldn't do it again.
Yeah.
But is there one big lesson that you say, hey, things have evolved in such a nice way or in such a different way that if I had known it by then, I would have done it this way?
You know, we all have things that are top of mind because it's the pain that we're facing currently, you know, and the pain I'm facing currently, which I think I would do differently if I started over again, was how I approached data. And this is a very tricky topic to discuss, actually, because when you're starting up, I think it would also be a fallacy to spend too many cycles wiring up data to be perfect, because you've got to just get product market fit and customer, you know, love and attention. But now that we're here where we are, I realize how easy it could have been to have a strong data philosophy and like now that I understand how our data needs to look, if I had that when I started, it would have reshaped how I approached very simple, like how we wire data, how we store data, how we transform data, how we report data, how we run meetings against data. All of that is not that difficult, but once you're 12 years in, changing the philosophy is hard. So
is that data about your company or is it data that you use inside the product to make the product become smarter?
I'd say honestly both. But if we had to be like, if you want to talk about mission critical, you know, key, it would be how we run our business, how we make decisions. Because what I realize about data now is like, it's great to have a bunch of charts and it's great to have a bunch of data, but if you don't have a decision-making framework against it, it doesn't matter. So it's really about taking it all the way into meetings and saying like, this is how we look at data. This is how we create a thesis. This is how we build, you know, conviction. And this is how we make a decision, all using the data and the antidote. Like our customer support teams, our sales teams bring antidote, but we don't have the data to back it. So, I mean, I'll be honest, like for the first 10 years of this company, we've made every decision on gut feel. Yep. And if we weren't so connected to the industry, we would have missed more than we hit. But because we know the industry, we hit more than we miss. And that won't work going forward. So it's like we have to rewire all of our thinking around data now.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, what are specific areas of data that you've come to value more than others?
So for one would be just key financial metrics. Like we just don't have a lens into them in a standardized way. So like, for instance, if you go to fundraise, investors are going to want you to talk about your financial, you know, information on the company in a very standardized way. And if you don't have that, it's very hard. Like you're forcing investors to try to create their own opinion. And I think investors are forgiving because when you're seed, series A, even series B-ish, they're forgiving to the fact that you're more worried about getting customers than having data. But you're leaving your company up to someone else's interpretation to understand when they don't know your business and they talk to 100 businesses a day, literally. So it's like, it's very risky to say like, here's some data, you tell me how my business is. The more you know about your business, the easier it will be to get an investor to buy into what you're doing. So that's one. The other one is, I've talked a lot about inputs and outputs. Most data everyone looks at is an output. ARR, MRR, NRR, CAC, blah, blah, blah. It's all outputs, but for you to start looking at inputs, you have to start wiring all the way into product, all the way into, you know, finances, what are happening on input levels and pivots too. So it's like, what is your CAC on Facebook for CrossFit gyms? What is your CAC on Instagram for yoga studios? Like, those pivot points are key too. And again, until you get to the point where someone goes like, what's your CAC on Instagram for yoga studios? You haven't wired it that way, so you don't think that way, you know? So that's one of those hindsight is 2020 things that I would change if I started over.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's all, and I also a good point about the inputs and the outputs, because yeah, the inputs at the end determine what the output is going to be like. And then you don't have to be surprised that sometimes it's better, or of course, often, yeah, like it's going to be worse.
Wiring the inputs, like knowing how to connect inputs and outputs, and the pivot points are so key, because if you can start to look at your stuff and go like, hey, Instagram yoga studio customer acquisition cost is 10x lower than Instagram CrossFit acquisition cost, they start to tell you the signals of where you need to lean. So a lot of times people think of these, like what's going, they think about data as what's going wrong. But the most important thing is like what's going right. And it's like, oh, wow, we had this unexpected crazy result from this action we took. Let's double that bet next month and see what happens. You know, and that's where the inputs matter so much.
Yeah, completely agree. Talking about, you know, you've mentioned a couple of times the word vertical, vertical product. You know, you've got a vertical suite for gym owners, for gyms. What are you specifically doing in order to still within that vertical segment to the right type of gym owners? What has become very important to you to kind of to get people that buy instantly from you rather than the ones that are constantly tire kicking?
Yeah, so it is a really good question. And our free product has created a lot of chaos in this area because everyone wants a free product. And so honestly, like we built this around CrossFit and CrossFit-like gyms, which are strength and conditioning and bootcamp gyms, because that's what we owned. Once we launched free, it's like we have fencing societies and we have gun ranges and we have Kumon learning centers. We have all these crazy use cases on our system because they're willing to make it work for free. The focus required, and I'm not by nature, I'm your typical starry-eyed entrepreneur, you know, lemonade stand, blah, blah, blah entrepreneur. So it's like, once I start hearing customer pain points and needs and like, oh, I'm a gun range. I need to be able to do X, Y, Z. Only a gun range would need. My natural instinct is go like, okay, can we build that? But you can't do that. Right. So it's like what we had to do pretty quickly was say like, our customer is a CrossFit and CrossFit like gym, strength and conditioning, coach led instructor fitness in a group setting, and not a yoga studio and not a Pilates studio and not a spin studio, very specifically this type of gym. And that allowed us to start making cleaner decisions on what we focused on. That's not to say we won't build for yoga and all these other things sooner or later, but it has to be on our time with our focus and our decision. And that was a struggle for a while, because I am completely a starry eyed, you know, I want to fix everyone's pain points, CEO, and we just don't have enough engineers to do that.
What has it led to? Because at the end, you know, you come to a realization that it is the best thing to do for your business.
So yeah, the interesting thing is this, like we only hire gym owners on our CX sales and onboarding team. All gym owners are empathetic as hell for other gym owners. So empathy runs through the company. Yeah. So what it's led to for us was like, oh my gosh, this, I don't know, insert gym that's not in any gym is having this one unique problem that's only for them. And then it would be like four alarms would go off, fire bat signals would be raised. Everyone would stop what they're doing to try and fix one person's problem because we care so much. And so it's an interesting thing where like our empathy, which is like our number one go-to-market motion, the number one thing that makes us stand out in the market, blah, 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 is also our biggest problem point, because every problem is 10x a problem because we care so much. And so it's hard to tell someone who's wired to be empathetic to gym owners to say like, don't care about that. We like, just ignore that, because it's going to derail this other problem that 1,000 gym owners have, right? So it is a hard message to deliver to people that like, we are empathetic, but also we can't care about everything.
Well said. And you could possibly even go further that within the stack of CrossFit gym owners, you still have a group where you will always get the deal and in others where they will never become a fan. Do you see that?
Absolutely. So there's segmentation, not only in types of gym, but in, I'd say, stage. So if I'm just opening a gym, I don't need a whole lot. If I've been in business for 10 years and I'm doing $1 million a year in revenue and I have payroll and I have like social media and all this, I need a lot more. So it's like, how do you build a product that not only scales across different fitness verticals, but I call it business acumen, like business stage as well. And that all of that's very, very difficult problem to solve. And, you know, generally speaking, ends up with a very confusing product that people don't understand. That was kind of our main entry point, is we wanted to build a simple product. So,
yeah. Yeah. So why is simple so important? Is that because of word of mouth or?
Simple is important. Simple is super important in small business in general, because small business owners don't have time. Like, they've just got to be able to pick it up and make it work, because they don't have time to train. They don't have time to write training manuals. They don't, you know, the amount of time they have and the amount, their attention is so fragmented that they've got to just be able to use it. And that, again, that goes across all SMB, because all, like, a baker is also the accountant and the janitor and the logistics person and they're ordering supplies. They have to do everything. So it's like, they don't have time to learn software on top of all
that. Exactly. Yeah. Well, I mean, I really kind of refer to my book, The Remarkable Effect, one or two times. In how you decide to run the business and what you put out there and what you don't put out there, do you have any metrics that are wired towards creating something that people keep talking about, start talking about, keep talking about?
So to be honest, we are just building that muscle right now. So my product teams are starting to wire and listen to, like, where the value segments are. So that's been a mandate we started making probably last quarter, is anytime we're issuing a product or building a product, I want to know what the aha moment triggers are or what the value metric is. And I want to record, let's record that. That should be going up and to the right, the number of times that happens as adoption goes up. And if that doesn't happen, then we need to rethink our thesis on, like, was that the right aha moment, or, you know, and just start to, again, sharpen that blade of becoming better at understanding what the customer actually wants.
Yeah.
So short answer, no, we don't have a lot of that yet, but I am starting to see more and more as we're releasing product features, like, hey, we identified the number of sales that happened through the staff app is the key thing. And that is up 142% week over week. So we're starting to get to those types of numbers.
Nice. Yeah. Okay, last question then. Based on the lessons that you learned starting companies and, of course, running this company yourself for 13 years, what would be a do and what would be a don't that you'd like to share with other aspiring tech entrepreneurs?
Is this in terms of, like, what they should do to run their business or how they should?
No, like the thing that is dear to your heart, that is part of your mantra, that is, like,
okay.
Yeah.
I would say definitely do. Work, build a company around something you are passionate about personally, because you will be beat up. I mean, the timeline will be relative. For me, I think I was beat up for 7 years. It was really, really hard to get traction for the first 5 to 7 years. And even when you're getting traction, it's not enough to, like, really fulfill, like, even right now, it's not enough to fulfill the amount of demand we have for things to build. So if you're working in an industry or a niche that you actually love, it's much easier when you're servicing customers you care about. I actually have friends who are CEOs running companies for, like, oh, we just identified shipping logistics as the best opportunity for us to build a company around. And then when it's, like, it starts to get painful, it sucks, because, like, they don't really care about shipping logistics. They're just doing it to make money. So do start a business around something you actually care about, because it won't make it feel like a job as much. Don't. I think one of the more painful things I've had recently is there is a fundamental need as you're growing your company to hire the right person at the right time to fill that any spot. And 90% chance that person won't be the right person if you continue to grow the company. So it's this weird situation where if everyone's doing what they're supposed to do, everyone will be growing, will be building a company that outruns their ability to maintain the seat that they were hired for. Don't wait to let people go or move them when the time comes for that to happen. And in fact, you might even want to hire people. And as you're hiring them, tell them, like, if this company achieves everything we're going to do, like, company's going to outgrow all of us, including me. And we all have to be cognizant of that, but you're going to get a better job because you're going to have succeeded here. Like, when you transition out and go to your next job, it will be a step up from here even. So I would, like, the mistake I made was transitioning people when the time came. The empathetic side of me was always like, I'm going to work with them. I'm going to make it work. We're going to try and figure it out. This is my guy. We're going to make it work. And eventually it isn't. You can't. And you just end up, like, wasting a year of their life, wasting a year of the company's life, you know, creating more friction across different departments. Just make the move. Don't drag that out.
Wise advice. And I think everybody can come up with an example where they failed on that. I mean, I did.
I, We all know in our gut when the situation's not right anymore, and we all think we're Superman and we can save it. But the reality is, like, 9 times out of 10, you're not going to save it. So just play the odds, you know?
True, exactly. So where can people go to find out more about PushPress or to say hi to you?
Yeah, so PushPress is just pushpress.com, kind of like it's spelled P-U-S-H-P-R-E-S-S.com. And I'm pushpress.com/Dan. You can find out, I guess, more about me and where I am and things I think and what I say there.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I mean, fascinating story. Thanks for sharing all the wisdom.
Thank you so much for having me. Love sharing with new entrepreneurs. And if you're out there trying to start a business, feel free to reach out. I'm always here to help anybody.
And this ends my conversation with Dan. And I hope you enjoyed it. And if so, please leave a review on iTunes. And if it inspired you, please share it with other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that you have in your network. Other than that, thank you for tuning into this podcast. I had the honor to speak to Dan Ohemura, CEO of PushPress. As said, the goal that I have in this podcast is twofold. Firstly, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. And secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what is required to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. Before I close, I have two more comments to make. If you know other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that have a story worth sharing, please send me an email at ton.dobby@valueinspiration.com. Building the momentum all starts with revealing the ideas, and that starts with you. And if you want to know more about my book, or you're interested in joining the Remarkable Effect tribe, please visit my website at www.valueinspiration.com. Thanks for tuning in. And you could do me a big favor by rating the podcast on iTunes or provide me with your feedback directly. I'll see you shortly on a new episode.